You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 31st of May, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview, a one-on-one show where people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers, and great tales sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got to here, and what makes them tick. Today we meet a man who's documented apartheid and the minutiae of Afrikaner life, who's probed his country's mining industry and used his lens to throw light on the individuality of ex-offenders. He's the leading South African photographer, David Goldblatt. Born in 1930, David grew up close to Johannesburg in Randfontein, a small town framed by gold mining and the fault lines of what would become apartheid. Since the 60s, he's devoted all of his time to photography, and over the decades, he's added undeniably to our understanding of what it is to not only be South African, but to be human. His life and works are the subject of this week's Big Interview. David Goldblatt, can we begin at the beginning? Why did you first pick up a camera?
I had several beginnings. I found that the camera, as evidenced in magazines like Picture Post from London and Life and Look from New York at that time, gave me a sense of the world that I could not get anywhere else. There was an immediacy and yet at the same time a sense of abstraction from the world itself that excited me. I was growing into the world then of the late 40s. I matriculated in 1948, and I was then, I think, 17 years old when I matriculated. So it was a world post-war, post-Second World War, and on the verge of the victory of the National Party in South Africa, which was a major event in the country and in my life.
You mentioned a number of different magazines there. How often did you get a chance to see those magazines? What sort of reading material magazines could you see in South Africa?
Those at the time were freely available, and I saw them frequently. I don't remember whether they were weeklies or bi-weeklies, but I saw them very often.
And was it a window into a different world that you were experiencing at the time?
Very much a window into a different world from the one that I knew. There were occasionally pieces about South Africa. Margaret Bourke White, the great American photographer, came to South Africa in 1948, I think it was, and did a major essay on the country. But basically, it was about a different world from mine.
And what was it that prompted you to decide you actually wanted to take photos yourself, that you wanted to be part of this world?
I think that there was a certain amount of ambition here. I wanted to become a magazine photographer. The whole field excited me. But it was, I suppose, deep down, this urge to use an instrument that seemed so capable of touching on the real world and yet abstracting from it. I can't put it more precisely than that. It only became apparent gradually to me over a number of years that what excited me was something outside of my own insight in the real world that provoked, excited, made me want to touch it. And that became touching it with the camera.
As you said, by the time you left school, South Africa was on the brink of a major change. Do you think that your early photography reflected that? Was that important to you?
I think that part of my ambition in becoming a magazine photographer was to be able to tell the world what was happening in South Africa. This was a very early ambition of mine, and it took me some time to realize that I was quite hopeless at that and that the world really wasn't very interested. But initially, certainly, I wanted somehow to make it clear to the world that what was happening in South Africa was a kind of epic change. We had come through the war as members of the Allies against Germany and Japan, against fascism and Italy. And many of our young men, the young men from our village, from Randfontein, where I grew up, two brothers of mine, were involved directly in the war. And one expected that after the war there would be a tendency towards liberalization. And on the contrary, that what happened was that people who had been interned actually during the war because of their Nazi sympathies were now in power.
Considering your background, not just obviously as a white South African at that time, but also as a Jewish South African and the son of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, how did those different identities affect you?
I didn't regard them as different identities. They were I was one person, and in my mind, I was. We had this knack in South Africa, and I suppose we still have it, of defining ourselves by our racial identities. So I was a white, English-speaking, Jewish South African of agnostic persuasion. So that
all
mad,
very carefully written down.
That mad series of identities or identifications were what defined me, but I didn't have any major problem of a sort of personality. My South African roots were very deep. I only came to realize this gradually. At first, after the National Party victory, I wanted to get out of the country. It seemed to me to be the obvious thing to do, and when I got married, my wife and I had the same sense that this was a bad place to bring up children. But during the 60s, I began to take photographs of Afrikaners, the people who were now in power, and of the mines, the gold mines that were dying at that time, the ones that I'd grown up in or around. And it gradually became clear to me that my viscera were in South Africa, and that if necessary, I would move, but it would be to a place, even if it was an English-speaking place, where I would be a stranger, where I would never have the kind of involvement that I felt with South Africa. And so that urge to move out, gradually it became clear to me that this was not for me. I'm not sure whether I bullied my wife into accepting that position, but she accepted it. We both, I think, a very strong attachment to South Africa. And if I can short-circuit perhaps what you might want to ask me, I have no wish to leave South Africa. I don't know what might happen if we were subjected to the extreme violence that sometimes people suffer in South Africa now because of the crime rate. I might then feel different, but it would take a lot for me to want to leave South Africa.
You mentioned the mines, and some of your most famous early work is on the mines. Why did you feel that was an important part of the country to document?
I didn't feel so much that it was an important part of the country to photograph the mines, the gold mines. I felt that it was an important part of my life. I grew up in a small mining town, gold mining town, Randfontein, and the fortunes of the town were pretty well the fortunes of those mines. When the mines declined, the town declined. My father's business was contingent on the existence of those mines to a great extent. And during my growing up, especially as a young boy in Randfontein, we had a tremendous amount of freedom as white kids. And we used to ride our bikes all over those very, very large properties. The mines around Randfontein were very big. They owned what was really a great arc of ground around the town. And we had the free run of it, as long as we didn't tread on what was known as caving ground, and which was fenced and marked as dangerous, and as long as we didn't intrude into the mining area without permission, we had a great deal of freedom. So those mines and the ambience of that time and of that place and of those huge operations became an intimate part of my life.
You say it's an intimate part of your life, and you know, when I tried to say it's about the country, like, no, this was important to me for my life. But do you feel that the work that you produced did have a sort of a wider influence, a wider impact than simply, for people like yourself who grew up around those mines?
I think I must make clear at the outset of this talk of ours that I have almost no idea whatever of the impact of my work.
Really?
None. I wish I could overhear the conversations that take place between people at exhibitions, mine in particular, I can't ever tune into them somehow, and I don't know what people really, really think.
Do you read reviews of
yes,
the books
I read
you've written
yes,
or
I,
the yeah. or the work you've done?
Yeah, sure, I read reviews, and I'm delighted when somebody writes a critical appraisal. I think that's a tremendous compliment to the work and to me, and I greatly enjoy that and value it. But the question of the impact of the work, I have no way of assessing at all. I don't know what it is. And that work, when it was first shown and published in the early 70s, caused hardly a ripple. So, yeah, I don't know. And frankly, I have to say that this is not why I take photographs. I don't make photographs to have an impact. It's a conversation between me and myself and my compatriots, the South Africans, among whom I live. But the extent to which the work actually penetrates in the minds and lives of my fellow South Africans is a mystery to me. I think there is a percolating effect. It's one of almost of osmosis, where photographs become part of the world in which we live, and I've no doubt that mine become part of that world as well. And somewhere, and every now and again, I hear a sort of a voice from somewhere that I've never met telling me how they've enjoyed a photograph of mine or a group of photographs. But it's very difficult to judge that kind of impact, and I truly don't know what it is.
You're a curious mix there of sort of both self-effacing and if you don't mind saying, selfish, that you're doing it for yourself and, oh, well, if other people like it, that's up to them. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely fair. Yes, that's quite true. I wouldn't claim that I have any beneficial effect. If I am part of that stream of work and consciousness that raises consciousness about issues, I'm delighted, I'm very happy. But yeah, it's often been pointed out to me that I'm not an activist, and I'm a curious blend of activity that in my own mind has almost no objective.
Let's assume that we believe you and that's why you want to do these things. Yeah. Do you look back at some of your work and think, actually, you know, some of the work that you did under apartheid, you know, whether that's, you know, for example, the work collecting the structure of things then, that you feel actually had perhaps not an impact, but showed people what was really going on here?
I wish I could be more assertive and say, yes, the work did have some effect and some consciousness raising power. And I hope that it does in my secret self. But I can't claim that it does. I don't know. I mean, the structure of things then was my most ambitious piece of work. It took me 15 years, and yet it hardly made a ripple. Only now, in 2015, are people becoming aware of the structures around us in South Africa as being a vital and barometric indication of values, which is what I said to start with when I began the process in 1983. So, yeah, I do the work. If people notice it, as I've said, I'm not being self-effacing, I'm not being falsely modest. I hope that it has an impact. I hope that it penetrates here and there. But I can't base my work on the belief that it does.
During apartheid, how was your work shown across South Africa?
South Africa was a curious place during the years of apartheid, in the sense that we had a totalitarian state with a very high degree of security and security consciousness. But we enjoyed actually quite a large measure of freedom. And I worked tangentially to the regime. In other words, I wasn't a news photographer, and so I very, very seldom was in situations where I was, as it were, in conflict directly with the authorities. And this gave me a lot of freedom to show my work as well. We had a little gallery at the Market Theatre, which was a place of non-racial integrated activity in theatre and photography and communal activities. I often showed work there. I had work shown in the National Gallery in Cape Town and in the Durban Art Gallery, but it wasn't widely shown at that time. I published work sometimes. There were several magazines that published my work, but it wasn't widely seen.
Do you feel it was seen more broadly outside of South Africa?
No, I don't think my work was seen more broadly outside of South Africa than it was inside of South Africa. I must make clear that I'm not... I made a very sharp distinction between my professional work and my personal work. The imperatives in these two areas of my life were different. So if Monocle commissioned me to do some work, my concern was to meet the needs of Monocle magazine or whatever your organization is doing. If, on the other hand, I wanted to look at that same subject for myself, perhaps for an essay that I was engaged in, I would do it with a different mindset. It's a bit schizophrenic because one often had to say to oneself, is this situation one that I can photograph for Monocle? Is it something that accords with my own beliefs? And if I felt that it was okay, then I would do it. But one had to be very wary in South Africa because frequently we treaded into areas that were close on being supportive of the government. And this I was not prepared to do under any circumstances.
On that issue, and the issue of sort of how you work, you know, within the confines of an apartheid regime, how do you? I mean, do you feel that there were compromises you made that you look back on and wish you hadn't?
Yes, certainly. There were compromises I made that I wish I hadn't.
May I ask what they were?
Well, I can think of one particularly that came up very recently. A couple of years ago, the rock drillers in a platinum mine or a series of platinum mines in South Africa came out on strike, demanding a living wage, 12,500 rand per month as a minimum. And it became clear to me then that this was a very important event, almost, not quite, but almost the equivalent of the revolution of the young students in Soweto in 1976. And if I can venture briefly into the economics of this, the black miners in South Africa are almost all, and were particularly so in the first 100-odd years of the mining industry, were all migrants. They came from all over sub-Saharan Africa. They spoke different languages. They had different cultures, as different as the Hungarians from the British, perhaps. And there was no reason to expect that they would form a solid proletarian mass. They were fractured and so were in a very weak position to bargain for their wages. The monopsonists, the people who bought labor, were monopsonists. These were the mining houses. They could easily collaborate and did in the setting of wages. And so the black miners, furthermore, were not permitted even to form trade unions for many years. So they were in an extremely weak position to bargain for their wages, for better wages. The outcome of this was that for very many years, they were severely exploited. In the latter part of the 1980s, particularly under a man called Cyril Ramaphosa, who's now the deputy president of the country, they did form a trade union. It was late. It was a latter day permission given, and they bargained for better wages and got them. But really, in relation to the whole period during which this had been happening, the improvements were minuscule. So going then into the new era of post-apartheid South Africa, there is still a huge lag between what might have been considered a living wage for these men and what they were getting. And I, like many others, succumbed during those years in the sense that I didn't fully understand the extent to which they were exploited. And so I did work for the mining houses. That was, I thought, permissible in my own mind as something that I could do. It wasn't in support of the government, but it was, in fact, in support of a system that was extremely exploitative. So that's a bitter regret. I didn't have the guts and the insight to see that then.
Do you feel your values have changed over time in terms of what you're looking for in your photography?
I say, when I'm asked as a very similar question, that I'm a straight line graph. If you look at my work and my values from the beginning to now, it's a straight line graph. I'm a monoculture. I grow corn. No, I don't think my values have changed substantially. I suppose I've become more acutely aware of some things. The values are pretty well what they were when I started. I don't think there's any substantial change.
And for you, has South Africa always been, you know, the country that you want to photograph, and South Africans the people that you want to photograph?
I formed, when I was the ambitious magazine photographer, the idea of the ambitious magazine photographer, it seemed to me that I would love to travel widely and photograph widely. And indeed, as I became a magazine photographer in my professional work, I did a fair amount of traveling. Although we were restricted severely in South Africa, in Africa, from where we could go, our passport was not acceptable. But it didn't take very long for me to realize. Maybe it did take quite a long time, but I realized that my roots are in South Africa, and the things and the people that engage me, that thing outside of my own inside that provokes and excites and irritates me, is in South Africa. And so that's my preferred place to work.
How much do you still work now?
Oh, I work all the time. My wife wishes I would take up golf. I don't do anything except photograph. If I'm not actually taking photographs, I'm working on photographs, looking at photographs. Yeah, I am a monoculture.
And in terms of digital photography and how photography is changing, there's been, you know, a lot said and written recently about the manipulation of photos and, you know, people using Photoshop too much. Yeah. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, my view is a very simple one. Photographers have manipulated their photographs from the very beginning. In the simple act of choosing what you frame when you put up the camera and take a photograph, you have already made a manipulation. The reality of what you're looking at and what will be recorded in the camera is not the same as the person standing next to you, because your eyes are not in the same position. So there is no such thing, in my opinion, as a virgin, pure photograph. They're all, to some extent, a manipulation of the photographer's eye, mind, and hand. Having said all that, quite clearly there are tools now available that make it very easy to change substantially the content of a photograph and its spirit, if you like. But then these things have always been available. You know, Joseph Stalin's PA system took Trotsky out of the picture when he became unpopular. It wasn't too difficult, and we can do that today just a little bit better and easier with Photoshop.
So it doesn't make you uncomfortable when you see, you know, for example, you know, the World Press photo recently, the judges saying that, you know, maybe a fifth of all the entries they felt had been manipulated too far.
Yeah, it's a grey area, obviously, and I think that judgment is obviously the essential factor here. What do you judge to be an acceptable degree of manipulation? I confess that I once did a photograph on an assignment, a magazine assignment, where I knowingly took a photograph that I knew I would have to have manipulated severely. It was of a very important house, and the whole story hinged upon the fact that it was almost untouched since the 1920s, and sitting in front of it was a Volkswagen Beetle. And I couldn't wake the man who owned it, because he had warned me the night before under no circumstances to wake him up. And I was there by his grace. So I took a photograph knowing that the Beetle would have to be removed. But it's not something that I did even in my professional work, and certainly in my personal work, I wouldn't dream of doing something like that. But I work with a man in Cape Town who does my scanning and the digital manipulation, if you like, of the final image, where we work as though I was in the darkroom. I sit with him at the computer, and we look at the scanned image, and we make changes that are very similar to those that I might make in the darkroom. But when he comes to a sky that's full of scratches and hairs and bits and pieces of foreign matter, he tells me to turn the other way. And every now and again, I will turn the other way so that he can manipulate the sky to clear it of these obstructions. But generally speaking, I don't manipulate beyond the degree to which I did in the darkroom, which was largely to change tones and contrasts, to emphasize certain aspects of a picture, to minimize others, which is what most photographers did in the darkroom from very early on.
Where and when are you happiest?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because people ask me after I've taken a photograph, are you happy? And I have to say, I'm never happy.
Photographers are never happy with their photos.
I don't think one should ever be completely happy with a photograph. There's always room for improvement, as I tell my wife with her cooking. It's worth 9 out of 10, but 10 out of 10 is a lot to hope for. I think I'm happiest when I'm working in the field, taking photographs of subjects that I'm in one way in love with, I think, even if they're terrible. I know that they're part of my world, and in that sense, I love it. And in contemplating the outcome of that work, I often have a great surge of pleasure. I think photography is a magic medium. And when you actually see the outcome of that medium before you, in front of you, it's an amazing surge of pleasure. That's about as far as it goes.
David Goldblatt, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks very much.
That was the photographer David Goldblatt talking to me, Steve Bloomfield, for the big interview on Monocle 24. Next week, tune in to hear me speaking to the journalist and writer Åsne Seierstad. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.